It is Friday, July the 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us today. Coming up, a deadly attack on Istanbul's airport.
The modus operandi of the operation looks like this is ISIS. How so? Multiple attacks, simultaneous attacks, attackers who mow down people with machine guns in order to cause the most number of casualties and then detonating themselves. That's also ISIS.
Also ahead, what's happening with Britain's leadership, slow progress against human trafficking in Africa, plus something new for iPhones. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Turkey says the three suicide bombers who carried out deadly attacks on the Istanbul airport were from Russia, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan. The death toll now from the blast at Europe's third busiest airport has increased to 44, while more than 230 others were wounded in the attack. Sonar Çaptay, director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute, tells International Edition's Ira Melman he is not surprised by the nationalities of the attackers.
We know that a large number of foreign fighters from Russia and the former Soviet states, including Central Asia, have unfortunately were able to go through Turkey into Syria in previous years and set up shop there, including joining Al-Qaeda-affiliate Nusra Front, as well as the so-called Islamic State. I think that the Islamic State picked those fighters with Central Asian and Turkic origins primarily because of their linguistic skills. If these people spoke Kyrgyz and Uzbek, these are languages related to Turkish. So they were probably able to, you know, move around more easily in Turkey than would have been the case for speakers of Arabic from North Africa or the Middle East, or people who came from Europe and did not speak any of the languages. And I think that definitely gave them the advantage of being able to move around the society without being identified necessarily because of their linguistic skills. And you also have the issue that, of course, Russia's northern Caucasus region has been a hotbed of radical activity. And when the Syrian war started, the Russians actually encouraged most of their radicals to flow out to Syria, because this to them was their way of exporting their jihadist problem into Syria. And now that jihadist problem, unfortunately, is being exported from Syria into Turkey.
So it sounds like that you do agree with the identification of those attackers as being ISIS attackers. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And what leads you to that?
Well, the modus operandi of the operation looks like this is ISIS. How so? Multiple attacks, simultaneous attacks, attackers who mow down people with machine guns in order to cause the most number of casualties and then detonating themselves. That's also ISIS MO, as we saw recently in Brussels and Paris and other places. So this is clearly linked to ISIS. And I think, though, the group will never assume responsibility. Let's be clear on this. Unlike in the West, and for example, in the United States and in France, where when ISIS carries out an attack, it goes ahead and assumes responsibility because this to it is propaganda to recruit unstable, violent-prone people from those countries. In Muslim-majority countries, ISIS never assumes responsibility for attacks because it likes to create an air of fog and suspicion. What do I mean by that? It carries out an attack, kills lots of people, one more, lots of people, does not assume responsibility. What happens next is in these societies, people start blaming each other. Government blames the opposition, opposition blames the government, suspicion rises, and soon you have retribution-style attacks. This is exactly what happened in Iraq. The mothership from which ISIS was spawned, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, carried out a large number of suicide bomb attacks in Iraq between 2005 and 2007, killing hundreds in each attack, never claimed responsibility for any of them. But after each attack, people started blaming each other in Iraq. The case was Sunnis versus Shiites, and that soon turned into retribution-style attacks and killings. And at the end, Iraq descended into a horrible civil war. I think that's the impact ISIS wants to create in Turkey by not assuming responsibility, so that it's hoping that the government will blame the opposition, in Turkey will be the Kurds and leftists, and they will blame the government. And, of course, then you're going to have this air of fog and suspicion, which ISIS loves, that's going to be the strategy moving forward. Should we see further ISIS attacks, they will not assume responsibility for such attacks. And I think in the face of that, Turks should be careful to avoid the Iraq trajectory. Instead, they should stay united against the face of ISIS threat, as well as identifying this group as a main and existential threat to their country right now.
And as Soner Çağatay, he is director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute. He was speaking with my colleague, Ira Melman. Time for the headlines, and among the top stories we're following on The Voice of America, U.S. adding 8 countries to the list of the worst human traffickers, Burundi marking independence with celebrations nationwide, plus the Indian Al-Qaeda offshoot designated a terrorist group. We have expanded coverage of these stories and a lot more at voanews.com and also on our VOA mobile app. In Britain, Conservative favorite Boris Johnson has said he will not be running for Prime Minister of his country. In announcing his decision, Johnson said after consulting with colleagues, he was not the person to lead the nation as Britain transitions away from the European Union membership.
My role will be to give every possible support to the next Conservative administration to make sure that we properly fulfill the mandate of the people that was delivered at the referendum, and to champion the agenda I believe in, to stick up for the forgotten people of this country.
Prime Minister David Cameron announced his resignation after Britain voted last week to leave the EU. Cameron was pushing for the UK to remain in the European Union. It is time now to check in with International Edition social media expert G. Abby Lee about what all the online buzz on Boris Johnson's decision might be as he does not seek his party's conservative leadership. Hey, G, did Johnson go to social media with his decision?
Hi, Steve. Absolutely. He's on Twitter at Boris Johnson and tweeted a link to his full statement he shared on Facebook. The Facebook post received more than 6,000 reactions. Many of his supporters left comments expressing shock and disappointment. A woman named Charlotte wrote, "I think you'd make a great PM. You are a people person and you care." Another user named Matt left a reply that got nearly 8,000 likes. He wrote a very long comment and ended it with, "No doubt, Boris will be back to lead the Conservatives once the chaff has been blown away. For today, he just dropped the mic."
Gee, tell us a little more about Boris Johnson.
Sure. He's a member of the parliament and former London mayor. Some media outlets tout him as the country's most popular politician. Before I go, I also want to bring up the reaction from Nigel Farage, who is a leader of the Independence Party.
Well, what did he say?
Farage sent out this tweet shortly after Johnson's news conference. He tweeted, "The next person to lead our country must be someone who intends to help fulfill our potential as a self-governing nation." Steve, back to you.
And many thanks to you, G, International Edition social media expert G. Abby Lee. You can find G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, is on Twitter at VOA_IE.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. State Department has released its annual human trafficking report, and again, Africa continues to be a major source and destination for trafficking of all kinds, from forced labor to sexual slavery. VOA's Anita Powell reporting now from Johannesburg.
Again this year, not one African nation made the report's top tier, which is dominated by developed Western nations like the United Kingdom, the United States, and Australia. The State Department says the ratings are based more on the extent of government action to combat trafficking than on the size of the country's problem. A significant number of African countries remain at the lowest possible ranking. Susan Coppedge, a senior advisor to the U.S. Secretary of State, said the migrant crisis that saw more than a million Africans, Iraqis, and Syrians flee to Europe last year has had a negative effect. She said the U.S. is trying to help the destination countries screen for trafficking victims.
So the migrant crisis creates a whole new pool of individuals who are vulnerable and susceptible to trafficking. If they are stateless or without documents or without jobs, without their families, they become vulnerable to the false promises that traffickers can give them for jobs or safety or shelter.
Jacob Christensen, a program manager for Awareness Against Human Trafficking, an anti-trafficking group in Nairobi, says he's especially worried about the effect of ongoing conflict in East and Central Africa.
I think the main change is the different migration patterns that, you know, we are seeing at the moment from places like Burundi and Somalia and South Sudan.
The report notes that in 2015, six African nations improved or introduced anti-trafficking legislation. It also noted that countries that improved, like Burkina Faso, the lone improver in West Africa, stepped up efforts to prosecute and convict traffickers. 10 African countries slid to the State Department's Tier 2 watch list this year. A Tier 3 ranking, the lowest level, can have financial consequences. Countries with that rating may face restrictions on non-humanitarian, non-trade-related assistance from the U.S. The U.S. may also lobby the International Monetary Fund to deny loans to Tier 3 nations. Half of the 27 nations on the Tier 3 list are in Africa, including two fresh demotions this year, Djibouti and Sudan. The tiny East African nation of Djibouti saw some 90,000 migrants pass through last year, creating opportunities for traffickers preying on vulnerable people. The report criticized Djibouti for not doing more to protect victims. Sudan, which separated from South Sudan in 2011, saw more trafficking because of movement of people between South Sudan and from heavy flows of African and Syrian refugees through the country. The report also expressed concern over child labor in Sudan. In 2015, law enforcement agencies across Africa reported the discovery of just over 12,000 victims of trafficking. But as anti-trafficking activists often say, such numbers are underreported, sometimes because of poor law enforcement, chaos, or because victims do not want to come forward. Anti-trafficking activist Natalie Ogden says the continent's most developed nation, South Africa, is making strides despite not moving up in the rankings this year. Ogden founded the Red Light Anti-Human Trafficking Initiative, which helps victims of sex trafficking in the South African city of Durban. She says in South Africa, a magnet for migrants from around the continent, the causes of trafficking are complex.
Human trafficking is almost the byproduct of various different other social ills within South Africa that haven't been taken care of.
The report acknowledges that no nation is without problems, including the U.S., and that ending trafficking is a difficult task and one with many complex roots. But the report says it is too important of a problem to ignore. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Italian Navy has recovered the migrant ship that sank off the coast of Sicily last year with an estimated 800 people on board. It has been deemed the worst known tragedy in the Mediterranean during the crisis of migrants trying to reach Europe. Only 28 people survived that particular sinking. Meantime, the European Union's Frontex executive director, Fabrice Leggeri, says that around 300,000 migrants currently in Africa could arrive in Italy through Libya over the next year. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following the latest migrant developments, and she speaks from Rome now with VOA's Kim Lewis, first about the significance of the recovery of the migrant ship.
Well, this is an amazing story. The Italian Navy has recovered a migrant ship which sank in the Mediterranean between Libya and Sicily in April last year with around 800 people on board. No one's really sure how many in total. And that disaster really does remain one of the worst tragedies we've seen in the Mediterranean migrant crisis. Only 28 people survived when this fishing boat capsized around 120 miles south of the Italian island of Lampedusa. And survivors said there were hundreds still on board. Tragically, many of them were locked in the hold of the ship, which is just so awful to imagine. What's been interesting about this vessel's recovery is the scientific approach that was taken. A specially designed robotic apparatus was used to physically raise this boat to the surface from a depth of 1,200 feet. And forensic experts hope to identify some of the victims, which is probably going to be quite a tall order. The wreck is being towed to a Sicilian port, and it's going to be kept in a particular type of refrigerated container during that journey to ensure that any remains of the victims are protected.
Wow, that's quite an amazing feat and really quite an amazing story after a year to be able to recover this ship from depths of over 1,000 feet. So at this point, any reaction from family members yet?
We haven't seen any reaction from family members. Only a handful, as I said, survived. At the time, the bodies of only 24 of the victims were recovered from that disaster, and those victims were laid to rest in Malta. A year on, I'm not actually sure if the survivors are still in Italy, but we're waiting to see if some of them might speak out about this and indeed try and find out if their loved ones are among those bodies that are on board this vessel.
In another development in the migrant situation, the EU's Frontex executive director is saying around 300,000 migrants currently in Africa could arrive in Italy from Libya. Could you expound on that just a little bit for us?
We've had a statement from the Frontex executive director, Fabrice Leggeri, who spoke to the Italian media this week, predicting that around 300,000 migrants currently in Africa could arrive in Italy via Libya in the months to come. According to his estimates, the Frontex estimates, he says there are around 300,000 planning to move from Western Africa through that central Mediterranean route. And he hasn't put a time frame on it. So far this year, we've seen about 64,000 arrivals in Italy. 300,000 certainly sounds enormous. The crossing season, as we know, is in the summer months. That's possibly going to drop off, I imagine, after September. Is he talking about this year, next year? It's not clear. But what he is saying is caution is necessary because there are so many different kinds of forecasts. And yet he says the number of migrants transiting through the Agadez region in Niger is showing around 13,000 people are moving through there per month.
Is Italy doing anything different in anticipation of this huge influx over the next few months?
Well, so far, the Italian government, as we know, is on the front line working with the European Union, the Coast Guard, the Italian Navy. All these vessels are coordinating massive rescue efforts on a daily basis. In the last week, we've seen more than 10,000 migrants rescued just off the coast of Libya. So there is this massive operation underway. The Italian government is about to open additional hotspots, these centres where they process the new arrivals, but it's unclear whether even more action will be taken by the government in the coming months to cater for this influx. I think we'll just have to wait and see how big the numbers are and how many continue to arrive in the coming months.
That is reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome. She was speaking with Kim Lewis, who is host of the VOA program Africa News Tonight. When President Obama leaves office in January, he says he will remain here in Washington, D.C. VOA's Bronwyn Benito has more.
Obama has already chosen the house where his family will live after leaving the White House. After stepping down, he will move to a large mansion in a wealthy Washington neighborhood called Kalorama. The mansion has an estimated value of around $6 million. Obama will not buy it, but rent it instead, paying around $22,000 per month. Obama said he is staying in Washington so that his youngest daughter, Sasha, can remain in the school she has been attending. The Kalorama district is considered to be extremely prestigious and secure. The reason is simple. The area has the highest concentration of embassies and residences of ambassadors and other officials in Washington. Local residents are used to the constant presence of police and Secret Service officers. Neighborhood historian Stephen Hansen says with the arrival of the Obama family, this area will become even more secure.
I think the neighbors might actually appreciate President Obama moving to the neighborhood. One of the stories right now is that through traffic to the street will be closed off and only available traffic access to residents. And security will be heightened, so they will not have to worry about so much about turning on their burglar alarms at night because the neighborhood will be well protected. And ultimately, it might actually improve their property values.
Obama will be the second U.S. president to stay in the nation's capital following the end of his presidency. Woodrow Wilson was the first. He lived in the same neighborhood where Obama has chosen to live. The Wilson House serves as a museum for visitors. It is in walking distance from the Obama family's future home. By continuing to live in Washington, Obama can't help but remain active in politics, certainly more than enough for an ex-president to do. For Tatiana Karchenko, I'm Bronwyn Benito, VOA News, Washington.
And still ahead, what to do about all those people who use their iPhones to take videos at concerts. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
To meet the demands for its energy needs while developing its own sources to become more energy independent, Britain's North Yorkshire County Planning Commission gave its approval to Third Energy to make this the first operational fracking site in the country. The site, known as KM8, is a chance for Third Energy to prove how safe it can be to extract gas out of shale rock. Company CEO Rask Ballin.
All the issues have been answered, and therefore it will be safe.
But water contamination and earthquake concerns from the water and sandblasting techniques used to extract gas remain for anti-frackers like Right Reverend Graham Cray.
We're not saying there could never be fracking. We're saying there are such serious questions about health, the economy, and the climate.
If all goes well and proves to be safe, the success of the controversial Rydell District site could help spark a growth in commercial fracking in Britain. From VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Apple company has recently been granted a patent that would disable an iPhone's camera temporarily. That would prevent fans from videoing or photographing live concerts inside the venue. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about this new software, which can also be used, they say, to enhance someone's experience at a museum or art gallery.
First of all, I don't think this is a bad idea.
And I agree with you. Now, I think we may be in the minority with this, but I think in theory, it's a good idea. I mean, as you say, if you've been to a concert recently, it is almost impossible to see over the phones. And we've heard a number of artists say on stage, please put your phones down or let me pose for a picture. Now, can you put them down? Because I would like for you to, I always say, see me through your eyes.
Well, Adele did that. Adele was in concert. I think it was in the Netherlands or somewhere, and or maybe in Britain. And she was like, no, love, no, right. I'm right here. No, really, put the phone down. I want you to see me live. And there were some artists who have actually stopped. There are some groups who have actually stopped their concerts and walked off.
Well, sure. And Alicia Keys recently in one of her shows asked that all of the concert goers put their phones in these little lock boxes that would not be unlocked or could not be unlocked until after the show. So you could keep it on you, but you couldn't use it. So this is actually a really big deal. And not only because I think artists want you to see them, but also because they have to be mindful of protecting their art from being distributed online without their permission and, of course, without them reaping any financial benefits from its spread. This is bootlegging, essentially.
Well, it's the way it works. Let's just explain it so people understand. The way it works is there would be a series of transponders in the venue itself.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain frequency that would be transmitted by those transponders, and that would hit your iPhone.
Right.
And if you tried to take a picture or you tried to do video, then you would get something on your screen that says, this function has been disabled.
Right.
So you could still call
Yes.
You could still text.
Yes.
You could still, you know, answer your phone. You just couldn't take any photographs and you couldn't take any video.
Yes.
I don't have any problem with that because back in the day, you couldn't take a camera into like a venue to take a picture of a concert.
Certainly.
It was on the ticket. No Certainly. Photography.
Yeah. And I think even like you say to these days, it still is on the ticket because I think artists really genuinely want people to enjoy it. But you can't take away people's phones because, again, they're almost like you know, appendages.
It's now, well,
like,
that's a civil liberties matter, too.
And it is. And now I think it's also, though, important to mention that this is not only about disabling the phone. There is another function that this software can be used for. And that is, let's say you're in a museum and you point your phone at an exhibit. A lot of information about that exhibit could appear on the phone as well. So those same infrared signals, instead of disabling your phone, can enable your phone to receive information. And then there are some questions, too, especially here in the States, about whether or not giving a company the ability to disable someone's phone in public is a good idea, since we've been dealing a lot with police brutality issues and knowing that sometimes being able to videotape certain occurrences affect the outcome of whatever issue should it go to court. But if you are a live music lover, this is something I think you need to be aware of because it may affect the way you experience your show for better or worse.
So are you a live music lover? Do you stream video, take video, or shoot photos when you go to see someone? Let us know your opinion. You can log on to our Facebook page. That's VOA Now. You can also send us a tweet. Shauna is at VOA Lady DJ or at VOA underscore music. Also, you can find Shauna's program, The Soul Lounge, on our website, voanews.com.
And many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America today for International Edition. You know, it's always great to have you with us. Reminder, you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is straight ahead. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zainab Abdelrahman, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Zimbabwean communities in the Yanga district will be able to construct facilities to dramatically improve their health and sanitation, thanks to assistance from the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, and its Community Water Supply, Sanitation, Hygiene, and Natural Resources Management, also known as CWASH program. In early June, at the Ruronquo District Development Fund Rest Camp, Robert Shawatama, the Provincial Water and Sanitation Subcommittee Chairperson for Manicaland, officially handed over to the people of Nyanga District $40,000 in materials to construct or rehabilitate 83 boreholes, 45 pumps to extract water, 105 drinking troughs for animals, and 102 latrines. Chairperson Chawatama also presided over the graduation of 18 community latrine and water pan builders and 16 village pump mechanics, who had been trained by Development Aid from People to People, or DAP Zimbabwe, with funding from USAID. With guidance from the District Development Fund, these builders and mechanics will assist the communities in constructing and repairing their water infrastructure and ensure long-term sustainability. In total, USAID's CWASH activities will provide safe and clean water to 2,400 households and 6 schools in the district. The communities of Nyanga North have long grappled with access to safe and clean water due to frequent breakdowns of boreholes. Some families travel for 10 kilometers to access safe water, while others sleep queuing for water at the boreholes. Many boreholes in the district are being chained and locked as communities try to safeguard limited water resources. Others have introduced strict water rationing, with households only allowed to collect 2 20-liter buckets per day, regardless of the household size. USAID is proud to support Nyanga District to improve access to safe, potable water, said USAID Zimbabwe Acting Mission Director Bruce Abrams. With this newly acquired technical expertise and building materials, these communities are now able to protect themselves against waterborne diseases.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's for